Our next case is King Ellis versus the Postal Service.
That's the one where we've got former clerks facing off against each other. Dowd, if I'm not mistaken, we have two of our former clerks facing each other in this appeal. We were thinking maybe we'd invite our clerks down to ask you questions.
I'm here to answer any questions of the court.
Okay, excuse me, Mr. Dowd, you may proceed.
Good morning, may it please the court. Matthew Dowd for petitioner Karen King Ellis. I presume the court's familiar with the record, so I'd just like to get to the three main points I'd like to make today. The first is that the credibility analysis performed by the AJ was both factually flawed and incomplete when you consider what Hillen describes. The second is that the AJ made incorrect and incomplete factual findings with respect to the clock rings, and that goes to the important question of intent. And the third is, even if you accept all the factual findings of the AJ, it's not reasonable to demote a 24-year award-winning manager for one incident over the course of a week when that station was understaffed and she was performing a job duty that is unrebutted, is generally not her responsibility. With respect to the first point, the credibility analysis.
I recognize
this court's standard of review. In terms, the court generally states it's virtually unreviewable. I agree with that, and that I think is applicable when there is a complete and accurate analysis performed by the administrative judge. In this case, we have two points. One, we disagree with the AJ's finding that it was inherently improbable for Ms. King Ellis to remember one time on each day within a 24-hour period. The second, a more important point, however, is that the AJ...
She was remembering specific times, 8:48 and 9:12. That's pretty hard to remember to the minute, isn't it? When you're filling the chart in a week later in some instances?
There's only one instance, first of all, it was a week later. In every other instance, it was the next business day. And in four out of the six instances, they were within 24 hours. That's one point. The second point is that the government makes a point of this, the AJ made a point of this, in that it sort of discredit Ms. King Ellis because of the point she remembered times down to the hundredth. That's just a red herring, Your Honor, because the system requires time entries to be entered that way.
But so isn't it, why can't we defer to her conclusion that it is inherently improbable that, if you take every person in this courtroom and ask them when they got to work yesterday, are they going to remember 8:48 in the morning? I mean, that there is something inherently improbable about recalling those details and that level of detail.
Well, I disagree for a couple of points. I don't think it's inherently improbable. Maybe it's unlikely. Maybe it's likely. But the fact that it's either likely or unlikely destroys the finding that it's inherently improbable. Inherently improbable just means it's almost impossible to remember. Now, you raised the question, well, what time did I get to work yesterday? I can give a pretty good accurate of what time I got to work yesterday. Can I remember every single thing I did throughout the day? No. And that's not what King Ellis's testimony was. On six instances, in a course of 6 days, she remembered one time for one employee. Now, the government and both the government and the AJ try to make the case that it was her testimony that she remembered everything that was going on. Her testimony is not that. Her testimony and the unrebutted testimony of both her and a former supervisor was that it was pretty likely and pretty possible to remember when a carrier left the office. It was a small station. there were about 15 or 16 carriers, and King Ellis just testified that she only made the changes that she remembered. Now, I'd like to point to a couple of specific instances that there are some. Now, Judge Rader, you mentioned the fact that in terms of the numbers, but there are a couple others. There are three others that are important, and I'd like to focus on those. Now, if you look at and if you look at the last six pages of the joint appendix, it starts at 822. They have the records there of the clock entries. The important point, and this is what the AJ did not go into in terms of its factual findings, right? The AJ focused on value, which was the first entry. Now, the AJ pretty much ignored the fact that Ramos, the time entry for Ramos, was a manual entry. And so what that meant was that at 11.29, which is maybe 11.15 in the morning, Ramos went in and manually entered a time of 10.76, about 10:45. King Ellis later came back the next morning within about 18 hours and testified to this and said, "Now I remember when Mr. Ramos left and it was earlier than that, and that's why I changed it." The Postal Service never talked to the carriers. The only person who testified that could remember these dates was Ms. King Ellis. The Postal Service never made the effort to even ask.
But her story changed, right?
I don't think it did change. Now, the government tries to say that it does change, and it focuses on the letter. And the letter is at JA-78. But now, if you look at JA-84, and this is right before she gets into the description of the changes, right about the middle of towards the end of the second paragraph, she says, "With respect to the clock rings, they were done to correct the clock rings to properly reflect the performance of these carriers on these days." Now, what she meant, and I think it's reasonable to interpret that, as she did it because that's what she remembered.
But why isn't the AJ correct that King Ellis could not have seen Bird leave at 8:48 if she actually clocked out at 9:27.
That is a great answer, and the government focuses on that. And there is unrebutted testimony from King Ellis's witness, Kay Giles. Now, as you might recognize, I got into this case later. This testimony wasn't included in the joint appendix, and I'd be happy to supplement the joint appendix if it's helpful. But the testimony is, and I'll read this actually, this is for Bird, the carrier Bird. She testified for a few carriers, but with respect to Valier, Kay Giles testified that based on the times that Valier left, it's no way you could have done all that and carried an hour off another route and then back by 7:30. It's almost impossible. So there's testimony, and this is unrebutted testimony from one of the witnesses, which the AJ clearly did not mention, refer to, or even consider in the decision, that supports King Ellis's version of events. Now, I grant that some of the entries seem more damning than others, but the point here, and the point I'm trying to make, is that the AJ made a specific finding about intent. Part of the reason why the judge approved the demotion was that she found this as an intentional and repeated. Now, I don't think that the AJ could make a proper intent determination without considering all of the evidence. If you pick and choose, that's not a proper determination of intent. It would be the same thing if
the situation... Well, they didn't charge her with falsification, right?
That's correct. And that's correct. And if I were here challenging the actual charge, that would be a good point. But here, my point is that the reason, and the main reason, I believe, that the AJ upheld this unreasonable demotion was because she found it to be intentional. And the intent is based on these incorrect findings about the clock rings. What I'm asking for the court to do is simply vacate the opinion, return it to the AJ, make a complete finding about each of the clock rings. It may be that the outcome is the same, But when this decision is based on the intent that's inferred to King Ellis, based on clock rings, and when the fact that the AJ ignored testimony that supports King Ellis's version of events.
Well, we don't know if she ignored the testimony necessarily. As you know, we don't have a requirement that an AJ or any other, you know, court necessarily deal with every single aspect of the testimony and so forth. So I'm not sure it's fair to say within her conclusion. I mean, obviously she didn't think that testimony swayed her the other way, but I don't think it's necessarily fair to conclude that she didn't consider it, right?
But I think when you put that together with the fact that the AJ made no factual findings about all of the other clock rings. Now, I'd like to point the court to figure one of the red brief. And this sort of tracks the factual findings made by the AJ. The AJ focused on six clock rings. And these are six clock rings 1 week out of 5 years that Ms. King Ellis was manager of the station. Now, what is ignored by both figure one of the government brief and by the opinion of the AJ is that there were at least six or seven other clock rings. And again, the question is, what do those other clock rings show about the supposed intent of Ms. King Ellis? Now, I have a list here, and if we could go through the actual employee everything reports, and for example,
before your time runs out, let me move you to what I think was your third point here, which is notwithstanding the result, the affirmation of the spec, you think the penalty should have been mitigated.
Yes, Your Honor.
Can you point me to any of our cases in which we've actually mitigated a penalty, particularly where it didn't involve a discharge or involved a demotion? Do you know of any case where we've second-guessed the agency and the board and actually mitigated a penalty?
Mitigated a demotion?
Yes.
Not off the top of my head, Your Honor. But that...
And that's probably, if I'm right about that, and I'm not positive I'm right, I've researched it, that's because the level of deference we apply is substantial, is it not?
That goes to the overall analysis of the Douglas factors, Your Honor. And with respect to whether it's a demotion or whether it is a removal, that goes to factor one of Douglas. And it's a question of the seriousness of the offense. And I think what could happen here is you look at this and say, well, this is only a demotion. It's not a removal, right? Because we see a lot of removal cases. But when you consider the seriousness of the offense, you know, the seriousness of the penalty, demotion basically puts Ms. King Ellis back to the same position that she first held 24 years ago. She'll turn 58 tomorrow. And she's worked for over a quarter of a century with the Postal Service.
And her duty will be to correct clock entries. Is that correct?
I was going to mention the irony of that a little later, but yes, Your Honor.
It does seem to be a little ironic. Should we hear from Mr. Goodman?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. First of all, with respect to the credibility determination, the administrative judge had three separate independent reasons why she determined that Ms. King Ellis' explanation that she had personally seen each of these letter carriers leave the office at that time was not credible. First, she said it was inherently impossible because she didn't think that she could remember it to that level of detail. Secondly, she said it was inconsistent with her written explanation. And that's important because the written explanation is the only thing that the agency had before them when they were deciding what penalty was appropriate here. They had Ms. King Ellis' written explanation that begins on Joint Appendix page 78. In that written explanation, Ms. King Ellis explained for each of these letter carriers why she made the change.
What harm did Ms. King Ellis cause?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
What real harm did she cause?
This software collects the data for all of the letter carriers so that the post office can decide how long a route needs to be, how many carriers they need per post office, and basically human resource management.
I'm sure that 1 week of entries is not going to change or disrupt a long pattern of practice. I'm still looking for that harm.
You're correct, Your Honor. I don't think 1 week is going to change the whole system.
Did it affect the compensation of these carriers whose clock was changed?
No, Your Honor. None of these changes affected the compensation except for the one change that she made that actually made sure that that particular employee was paid on that day.
So what motivation would she have had to falsify these records?
There are a couple of different possible motivations, but more importantly, the administrative judge did not find that she had any kind of malicious intent here. There was some discussion earlier about the intent. I believe when the administrative judge was talking about intent, what she meant was that Ms. King Ellis intentionally made these changes. That's to be contrasted with Mr. Mitchell, charge one, where the administrative judge found that this was purely an accident.
But she had intentionally made these changes, and the changes were unwarranted, and therefore she was providing incorrect information into the system, right? You have to conclude that.
Yes, Your Honor. She intentionally made the changes, and these changes should not have been made, and therefore there's a problem with the data.
What's the motivation for her having done that? As Judge Newman pointed out, there was no pecuniary advantage for any of the employees.
No, Your Honor. There are a couple places in the record, starting again with her written response, where Ms. King Ellis talks about how important it is to her that she be known as a good manager and that she's won a lot of awards for the efficiency of the operations at her station. And that's a, let's see, joint appendix. Well,
so if the government concedes that was her motivation, then what motivation would she have had to fabricate anything? Her motivation would have been to get it right.
Her motivation would have been to make her station look more efficient. And if the letter carriers at her station were spending too much time sorting the mail and not enough time out delivering the mail, then by changing these particular records, it made it look like her letter carriers were more efficient. That would indirectly benefit her. But again,
is there any testimony in the record? Did somebody testify that her status and her appraisal of her function was contingent on this, you know, efficiency aspect, which is affected by the difference in 1 hour clocking out or whatever?
There's no testimony, Your Honor, that it's directly contingent upon it. There is testimony suggesting that it's important how efficient the operations look and that she is evaluated. The degree to which she's evaluated is not clear, but that she is evaluated based on the efficiency of the operations at her station.
Was there testimony that the 1 hour more or less affected that?
No, Your Honor.
View?
There's no indication that these five changes actually resulted in her station looking more efficient and in her getting, for example, an award for that. There's nothing that direct. There's testimony that she would care about this, and there's testimony from her that she did in fact care about this. And she said, both in her testimony at the hearing and in her written response, she said, these are the things that matter to me and this is important. But again, what's most important here is that the administrative judge did not reach the question of falsification. She wasn't charged with falsification. It doesn't matter for purposes of this case whether she was doing this for a malicious reason or whether it was just an accident. All the administrative judge found is that she intentionally made these changes, and those changes resulted in her station looking more efficient than it otherwise would have. That's all the administrative judge had to find, and that's all the administrative judge found. And
so if it was just an accident, what does that mean? That she really did believe, maybe she was looking at her watch the wrong way, but that she believed that indeed the entries, the revised entries that she put in were correct. Does the government concede that?
No, Your Honor. We don't know here. There was no finding as to what her intent was. But even assuming for the sake of argument that she didn't have a malicious intent, she still made a series of changes, and that gets to the appropriateness of the penalty. She made a series of changes, all of which made the station look more efficient, and she didn't give the agency an adequate explanation for why she made those changes. She was the final say at that station. The post office personnel, the supervisor,
she gave an answer as to why she made the changes. She said that that's the time at which she observed those people leaving.
That's the explanation she gave at the hearing to the administrative judge. To the deciding official, the explanation she had was the explanation in her written statements,
Okay. Each
of which are belied by the data at page 822 to 827 showing what the software actually indicated. The software indicated a set of changes. Her explanation for each of those postal carriers doesn't line up with that.
Well, wait a minute. I mean, her explanation, as on page 84, is they were done to correct the clock wings to properly reflect the performance of these carriers on these days. How is that inconsistent with what she testified?
She goes on, Your Honor, to explain for each of the letter carriers individually.
Okay.
For example, for Mr. Vallier, she says, the only two moves that Mr. Vallier put in were his begin tour and his end tour. If you turn to page 822, in fact, you can see that he put in a move to the street at 12:30. Moving to Ms. Bird, she says Ms. Bird never moved to the street on her regular route at 9:24. In fact, if you look at page 823, Ms. Bird moved to the street at 9:27. If you look at Mr. Heitzman, she said the carrier failed to move the street. I moved him to the street at 10:48 and deleted my own move, not his, at 11:48. In fact, that move at 11:48 was made by Mr. Heitzman, and she was correcting that. So each of these, and I can go on, each of these are inconsistent with what the time records demonstrated. That's what the agency had before them when they were deciding what penalty to assess. They saw a situation where the manager of the station had made a bunch of changes, and she didn't have an explanation for any of them that lined up with what the software showed. They decided not that she needed to be fired. They decided that she needed to not be the final say at that station. They needed a manager, somebody to supervise her, to oversee her work. So they installed a manager at that station and demoted her to a supervisor somewhere else.
But when she does these things then in her new job, the person over her doesn't really monitor everything she does, right?
It is the duty of the person over her to monitor this and make sure that it's accurate. I'm sure it's a spot check system. Not every single change she makes is monitored, but it is the job of the manager to make sure that the supervisors, which are below the managers, that the supervisors are making changes appropriately. So in her new position, she'll have a manager, somebody overseeing her, making sure that each of these changes are done properly. Again, that's what was before the deciding official. This is clearly not overreaching or an arbitrary decision. They decided that she was rehabilitatable, she could stay in management, but that she needed somebody to supervise her. And that's a reasonable response. And of course, with this court standard of review, the court just needs to make sure that there was a reasonable exercise of managerial discretion, and this was. There are no further questions, Your Honor. I'll sit down.
Thank you, Mr. Goodman. Mr. Dowd, you have almost 3 minutes.
Just a few points, Your Honor. One, with respect to Bird, one of the factual findings that the AJ did not make with respect to carrier Bird was the change that King Ellis made that actually shows the carrier on the street for less time. King Ellis deleted an 11:30 move that was manually input by Bird. The AJ makes no factual findings. Why is this important? Because it goes to the motivation and it goes to the overall intent that the AJ infers King Ellis had. Now, the government responded saying that with respect to the new position for King Ellis, the government responded saying that someone oversees her now. The unrebutted testimony and evidence in this case is that the supervisors do this and basically they have complete discretion. That was King Ellis' testimony. No one rebutted it. And there was a supervisor who testified and supported this version of this. So she is now in a position where she's responsible for doing the very thing that they're accusing her of doing intentionally to misrepresent the statistics. Now, with respect to the government's argument that this somehow sways or changes the statistics of the station, that's not supported by the record either. I mean, when you look at this is 5 years as a manager of this station. The only instance is 1 week when she was doing a job of her supervisor, who was below her, who was out for that week. The only reason this came up was because she was originally charged with an incorrect overtime correction for Carrier Mitchell. She was later exonerated by that, but the officials at the station, or at the management, started looking into other things to support their demotion of Ms. King Ellis. Now, Your Honors, I understand that the deference given to the board in this case is high, but demotion in this case is a serious penalty for something that there's no proven intent to do something malicious for personal gain. This is a complete error on the part of King Ellis. for the findings that the judge made. I'd ask that this court, at a minimum, send this case back to the board, have a complete factual finding for each of the clock rings, including the ones that are omitted from the opinion, and then have the board determine whether this is a reasonable penalty. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Dowd.